Hey, folks, you're listening to Chew the Fat with Chef Craig Hartman here in the beautiful studios of the Charlottesville Radio Group with our producer, Mike Bisaglia, the world-famous Mike Bisaglia. And, you know, we're the podcast where you hear all about food-related items. We have raw interviews, in-depth, deep interviews into the psyche and the minds of people who are behind the food in your area. So without further ado, tonight we have a really cool podcast for you. We have a food blogger, voted best food blog. I'm not going to say which periodical, but has been voted best food blog. It's one of my favorite food blogs because she once said one of my foods was her fifth favorite, or top five favorite. So to me, that makes a good food blogger. And anyway, tonight we have Janae Libby from Edible Seaville. That's edible-seaville.com. And we're happy to have her. How are you tonight?
Oh, doing great. Thank you for having me.
Well, I think it's really great to have you. You know, we've talked to a lot of chefs here. We've had a couple other food journalists. We had a writer of the book, The Modern Gentleman, here. All of these folks have this extreme deep passion for food. Do you have that? Do you have this deep passion for food?
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Where did this come from?
Oh, my Southern upbringing, definitely. Both grandmothers could cook their butt off. I mean, they were born and bred here in the Shenandoah Valley. One's from Waynesboro, the other one was from Front Royal. And gatherings at both houses were all around food. I mean, everybody gathered around the table at holidays, at funerals, you know, twice each summer for barbecues. And they all cooked and we ate. And so it definitely instilled that love of food.
Are those cool memories for you?
Oh, they're the best memories.
Yeah,
they're the best.
I remember as a child, my family used to have these great big cookouts, and then they might play like softball or baseball or volleyball, and then you run in and you'd eat and you run back out, and you know, they have the big things with Coca-Cola and ice baths and grilled foods. And I think back to those memories, and I just think in my life I wanted to recreate this in my adult life, and I think that might be why I became a chef. So did you have those feelings? I mean, is that like, are they kind of romanticized feelings?
Oh, exactly. I mean, I can, some of my fondest memories were in my Nana's backyard, and we would pick crabs. Like, we would would put brown paper on the picnic tables and get bushels of crabs and just sit out there all afternoon and eat and barbecue chicken on the grill. And I remember I was in Scotland, and I was trying to explain to this guy about what that was like, and he looked confused. So I immediately went back like that summer, and I took pictures. I was, you know, the next crab picking we had, and I sent it to him. I was like, see, look at this. Isn't this fun?
Yeah.
I don't know, like really nostalgic, romantic. Everybody's together. Everybody's dirty. They're all drinking beer, and there's crab shells all over the table and all over the ground. And just, I love it. And it instilled that passion of food in me. And so when I went to write, you know, that's what you write about, is the stuff that's your truth and that drives you. And so a lot of that is food. And even in my stories and in my essays that aren't about food, food always finds its way into it because it's just such a part of me.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about your life before you started a food blog. What did you do?
Oh, my God.
What did you do? What didn't I do? Should we do what didn't you do?
How much time do we have?
Well, I wasn't an astronaut.
I wasn't? Yeah. Oh, let's list the jobs that I have not had. Like, let's start there. No, I've had a pretty my path has definitely not been straight. It has definitely kind of curved and gone off and come back. But I've always written. I've been a writer since I was a kid. I mean, I always kept journals and...
Sure.
And, you know, wrote thoughts down and wrote stories and stuff like that. And it's only been just recently that I've decided to, you know, hey, instead of doing all these other jobs, maybe I should work on this more than I have. I mean, I've done everything. I was a bartender. I managed a cookie store, a chocolate store. I was a waitress. I was a barista.
What?
I worked in an office. I worked in a hospital for a while. I was a school teacher for 8 years.
Wow.
So...
Did you teach English?
I did.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
To eighth graders.
Oh, man.
Or tried to.
My eighth grade English teacher, she hates me. I hope she forgot all about me over these years. But, well, it's really cool. So you... Did you go to college? Did you do literature and writing?
Yeah,
and
I majored in English at VCU, and, uh-huh. and had great experience. I mean, I had two teachers there, Leslie Scheel and Richard uh-huh. Fine, and they were just complete mentors to me. I mean, I went to Scotland because of Dr. Fine,
right?
And Leslie was my writing mentor, and I'm a better writer because of her. I mean, if I had not had her classes, I would not be the writer I am today. I mean, I still have her voice in my head telling me, you know, go vertical with this, uh-huh. you know, stop here at this moment and go vertical. Because she was such a great teacher.
What does that mean? Go vertical. I might need this. So
if you're writing along, like you're telling a narrative, like this happened and this happened and this happened, sometimes it's good to stop and really delve into that moment.
Right.
Describe what you saw, what you smelled, what the person looked like.
Mm-hmm.
What gestures they were making, and so the reader connects to that,
sure.
and can see it in their head.
Yeah,
and so I try and do that. I do it as often as possible,
because right.
I think that's what good writing is you get other people to connect to something that you're reading.
Sure,
and they go, "Oh, I've felt that way, or yeah. I've experienced that. Wow, let me keep reading and let me buy her book." And
did you ever feel that writing was a discipline? Remember they used to tell us that. Writing is a discipline?
I think to be a good one, it is. And God, I'm the laziest writer on the planet. Oh, it's awful.
I think it's awful. I once was writing for the Ithaca Journal, and while I was a chef at Cornell, and I would rather do sit-ups than write, actually. So I told someone, I really think this is true, you know, because if you have a deadline and you're writing, you know, it really, it puts a lot of pressure on you,
yeah.
and it's very stressful. And then you have people reading your blog, so you obviously don't want them to read things that are grammatically incorrect or sound stupid or cheesy, right? So
exactly.
I had a lot of pressure. Lucky for me, I had some good editors, you know, and students at Cornell were very, very smart kids, and they would read everything. Oh, chef, you don't want to write that. That's ridiculous. You need to say it like this. Thank you. So, I actually admire people who can write, because to put feelings down in a way that people can read and understand, I think is an art, you know, just like, you know,
I agree.
Like my brother does, or painting like my mother does, or child whispering like my wife does.
Yeah, there you go.
These are all arts.
Yeah, it's an art, and you have to hone your craft and practice and, you know, part of that too, I think, is finding your strength. Like, since I've started this blog, I've had a lot of people suggest what the blog should be and how
mm-hmm.
I should do
yeah,
it
sure.
and what I should write about. And that's been a real, like, growth process for me. It's like, well, I don't care about that. I don't want to write about that.
Yeah.
Like, no, I'm not going to do that. So,
sure.
But it's helped. I think I've gotten better.
Yeah.
By
well, let's talk about your blog now. Edible Seaville. It's kind of neat. You know, the whole internet has been neat. And I remember we had a website when we had Clifton Inn, when there were less than 50,000 websites in the world. And now this thing has grown, and social media is kind of the wave of the future.
And
I feel like people like yourself are kind of the pioneers, you know, coming into this whole thing. I say pioneers because, you know, it might be a few years in now, and people are doing these kind of things, but still it's an infant compared to,
sure,
you know, the millennia, you know what I mean?
This is
really the beginning, and I feel that social media is huge. And so here you are, you have your blog. How did you actually think of this idea to do this? What were you thinking?
Oh, to do a blog.
Yeah.
You know, make a long story short. My husband and I were living in Pittsburgh mm-hmm. in 2006.
Right.
And like I said, I've always written, I've always typed things and kept journals, but I actually had a tragedy happen where a couple of friends of mine died under
uh-huh.
really tragic circumstances. And I thought to myself, and it made me really sad, and I was
right.
grieving really badly. And they were such great people, as the Harvey family in
uh-huh.
Richmond.
Yeah.
and I was good friends with them, mm-hmm. and I wanted people to know who they were.
Right.
And so I started a personal blog called Epizootics, mm-hmm. which is kind of a Southern term for coughing.
Right.
My grandmother used to say, if you were sick, you had the Epizootics.
I'd never heard that before.
Yeah. Are you catching the Epizootics? So I just said it was my blog for little coughs of thought. Mm-hmm. And I started writing about the Harveys. And then when I was done with that, I started writing about other things. And that led me to other memories that I had of my family and my mm-hmm. friends and things I cared about. And that kind of led me to food. And I started a blog called Edible Pittsburgh.
Right.
And I started reviewing restaurants. And then my husband had to go get another job in Charlottesville. Thankfully, because we were really done with the weather by that point. I mean,
sure.
Pittsburgh's a great town. Young, hip, lots of stuff going on, but the weather uh-huh. stinks. And we moved down here, and I just kind of moved the blog to Charlottesville. And I was thinking of a good hook to have, and there were already a couple people over at Savillan reviewing restaurants.
Sure, yeah.
And I said, well, I'm brand new, so that'll be my hook, you know, new eyes, new added, you know, a brand new person in town. What do I think of these restaurants? I mean, these people have been here for a few years, or they may have been born and lived here their whole life. And so it kind of evolved from that. And, you know, after a while, I got tired of reviewing restaurants. I was still writing on Epizootics, but I was like, mm-hmm. God, I was discovering food writing as a genre. I had picked up Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential years back, which led me to Michael Ruhlman's work,
mm-hmm.
which led me to MFK Fisher's work and Ruth Reichel's work, and, you know, on and on.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I could do this. I could write about food. I've got, you know,
those are some good food writers. Well, MFK Fisher, by the way, is my all-time favorite. My all-time favorite book, Consider the Oyster.
Mine too.
Yeah.
Mine too. That is so weird.
I love that book. And I grew up in Ocean City, Maryland in the summers. And my great-grandfather down there was an oysterman, and I grew up with these oysters. And Mom gave me that book that she was given in like 1937 or 1940, whatever, by her mother. And I have the book, you know, signed to her, and I read that book. And it really changed a lot of the ways I think about food. And that's just a simple little book like that.
Yeah, just a tiny little thing. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny you said that, because I had read A Movable Feast in college as mm-hmm. an English major. Right. And my favorite part of that book is where he talks about oysters and Chablis and the way they uh-huh. taste together. And I was talking about that with someone, and she said, you need to pick up MFK Fisher's book. Because, you know, if you like that passage, then you obviously need to read this. And
oyster stew from there.
Oh, yeah.
Which I grew up eating oyster stew, almost the same exact recipe anyway.
Yeah.
You know, from being out in Ocean City. But at Fawcett's at Keswick, I had MFK's oyster stew on there a couple winters in a row.
Oh, nice.
And a lot of people are like, who is MFK Fisher? Which I say, well, you need to, you just need to buy How to Eat a Wolf. And
exactly.
And, but see, I think that's neat that you, from your background, you started finding this. So you start the food blog here in Pittsburgh, and then you come down here. How have you felt the reception from readers and the local folks?
You know, I've gotten really good reception, really good reception. I do think, boy, people that read food blogs and people mm-hmm. that go to restaurants have some of the strongest opinions about things, even more than politics and religion. And if you talk to Masta Millers, I think they would agree with me.
Yeah.
The other awesome restaurant reviewing blog in town.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause you can say something about a restaurant that people have been enjoying for years, and you're new in town, and how dare you say something about this particular restaurant's dish that they love? And it's like, well, you know, it's just my opinion. I'm just one person, and I'm not, you know, I haven't been to the Culinary Institute to train, but I have definitely cooked and eaten a lot of food, and I think I have a great palate, and I know what I'm talking about, and I'm an adventurous eater.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I think, you know, over the years, there's some big blogs. I know DC, you know, DonRockwell.com.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they have forums on there, and, and people write in. And, you know, it's been one of those blogs that restaurants have, it became so strong that restaurants decided they're going to hire people to write on blogs, you know. So they'll have people that just write on these blogs reviews about their restaurant, and they go in under fictitious names. I know that Don Rockwell's been really good in identifying, you know, these people and sometimes kicking them off.
Sure.
But I've talked to a lot of chefs about this, and a lot of them get a little prickly over some things that readers of these blogs or contributors to the blogs, not the person who has the blog, but things that they'll say about their restaurant, you know, because it seems to me that a lot of the forums are a place where people can express themselves.
Exactly.
But sometimes, you know, they express themselves just to be heard in a certain way. Have you found that? Like, do people reply to you in a way sometimes that you have to maybe not add to your blog their comments?
You know, not often. I of all the comments I've gotten, I would say only maybe 10 to 15% of them are truly ugly. And if it's a constructive criticism, I'll address it. I will post it. I've no fear. I will post it and I'll address it and just hopefully start a healthy discussion. But I have had a few comments where they are just downright ugly comments that don't need to see the light of day. And I'm like, okay, yeah, delete. You don't need to. And they're always anonymous.
Sure.
Funny enough, well, they're always
the funny
anonymous.
Thing is, it's kind of the whole social media thing's a two-edged sword in a
way.
You know, it's a place where anybody can go and say what they want about any place. You know, on a lot of these sites like TripAdvisor and Yelp, Urban Spoon,
right?
And you know, being a restaurateur. Lucky for me, not fine dining right now, but people still are the same. They'll get on there and they'll say things that, you know, are kind of hurtful to a restaurant. And
I never understand that.
On the other hand, people say nice things too. So we want that.
Sure.
You know? So even if you're, you know, but you also, you know, for myself, I look at those comments that people make sometimes if they're hurtful. But I always look at it like, well, maybe there is a shred of truth here that I need to really look at.
Right.
And see if I need to make a change. So even though it's a two-edged sword, I think it's something that we're going to have to get used to because I think this is here to stay. What do you think?
Yeah, me too. I definitely think so. I mean, it's been great for me hobbling along learning social media just to get new readers to the site and people from not just Charlottesville, but D.C. and Stanton and other regions that are traveling here.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but I've gotten a lot of people from D.C. that have found the blog and asked for my recommendations. And
sure.
So, and I've got a tough skin. I mean, in writing, you have to. I mean, not everybody's going to like your tone or what your topic or how often you write or how little you write. And I've got people, I know that all they want to read is restaurant reviews. I know, but that's not all I'm about. Yeah. So.
Well, the restaurants like to read them if they're good.
Sure.
Well, about them.
Well, I like when I first started, I did have a few really poor experiences and I spent a lot of time writing about them. And it was always really weird for me because I've worked in restaurants. I've never, I've been a prep cook. I've never worked the line and I've never been a chef and I've been a waitress. So I've seen the other side of it and maybe they were having a bad night. Maybe it was really overly busy. So now, if I have a super bad experience, I just don't write about it. I write about the good experiences, the good reviews. If I have an extraordinary night, I run home. I take notes. I run home and shout it from the rooftops.
Yeah.
And if it's bad, I had experience yesterday. It was kind of mediocre, and I might mention it on Facebook, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time tearing them down about it because I mean we're all here to learn and work and grow and. And there's no need to be ugly. I mean, it's hurtful.
Yeah, that's true.
You know?
Well, you know, maybe it'll help them sometimes if there's something.
Right. If there's one particular thing that they could have maybe they didn't notice and could fix or something.
I mean,
like
I know
that.
As a chef, when I would walk out and talk to people and I would ask them how everything was, if they looked at me and they said, It was good. It was good. I know.
Yeah.
It was not good.
What?
And I
right.
have to look at them in the
right.
eyes and say, well, what exactly happened tonight that you thought could have been better?
Yeah.
And then they'll start opening up, but sometimes they won't. They'll just look down and look away, and I'm like, man, what happened to those people, you know? And then, of course, I got to round up the wait staff. I want to know what happened to that table. You tell me what happened. And what did they do? What did they eat? Why didn't you bring their plate? What did they have? You know, was it hot? Was it cold? Did you get it fast? Did you forget the thing? And so, you know, as a chef, you get kind of crazy over that. But so I think, you know, if you're writing on a blog and you say, you know, we had this restaurant experience, this is how it was, and you leave out really bad details, we don't put any really great details, and that restaurant's going to know they got something to deal with, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, if I were a writer, if I had that discipline, which I don't, it would be neat to be able to write like you, but then, you know, I'm already doing a couple other things. So
do you think, do restaurants want to hear if it's been a bad experience?
I think no one really wants to hear it, honest to God. But if they're
like, oh, she came that Tuesday, that was a terrible Tuesday.
If a restaurant cares, I mean, if they truly care about their experience, if they truly care about their guest's experience and that they're passionate about food, they're going to want to know if there is something happening that they don't see.
Oh, okay. Okay.
You know? Because every really good person that I've interviewed, too, they totally care. I mean, they're in it. They're working the long hours.
Work.
They have the passion.
Yeah.
And if there's something happening, they want to know about it, even when they don't want to know about it, but they got to know about it. So I think most of them, yes, they would like to know. Even if it's not written about, maybe just an email like, hey, I was there.
Oh,
you know,
that's a thought.
This
okay.
is what happened.
Okay.
I'd like to come back again, you know, or something like that. And then because I really think we all want to know. We hate to hear it, but it helps us. You know what I mean?
It's always such a prickly situation for me, too, because I know of another reviewer situation where they started the meal and they were not having a good time or they were not having a good experience, and the restaurant happened to know that they were a reviewer, and so then they started showering them with free stuff, and that always makes me so uncomfortable because
True.
You can't buy my good words. I mean, just... So I never know what to do.
That happened with Keswick Hall when they first opened.
Right.
Phyllis Richmond came there to eat. Now, I was jealous because I had Clifton at the time, and Phyllis Richmond had not been there, and she was the food writer to us of all food writers from the Washington Post. And they recognized her after a little while, and they just went crazy over her, and then they left everybody else around them ale. And she was so embarrassed. She wrote a very bad article, and Bernard Ashley fired pretty much the whole culinary staff, the chef, the maitre d', and everybody, as soon as that article came out. And, you know, really shows you. Then I was actually afraid to have Phyllis Richmond come, especially after she wrote about a chef.
You want to be nice, but not too nice.
No, she wrote about a chef from a restaurant in Washington that's known for its fish. She said, what this chef knows about fish, he probably learned from McDonald's.
Oh,
and I remember reading that in her Sunday thing and thinking,
that's
wow, if a writer ever wrote something like that about me, I would be like, oh, Harry Carey, you know, I'm done. You know, I've been working this hard. But, you know, I think food writing is so integral part of the whole culinary experience, because chefs have said in my interviews with them that one of the ways that they stay inspired is by reading the works of food writers.
Oh.
Blogs. They just are always reading, and I find it's kind of a common thread. When they're not at work and they're in relaxation, they're reading something about food.
Right.
And they've said it over and over.
Mm-hmm.
And so... you know, the question is, hey, guys, how do you stay inspired? Well, you know, I'm reading all the time. Anything that's relevant about food, I'm reading it. And so I think, you know, what you're doing is the same as what we're doing. It elevates food and beverage by people working back and forth. So it's kind of an integral part. The winemakers, what they're doing.
Oh, sure.
Along with, you know, what we're doing and what you're doing. Also, it's all kind of works together to elevate. And I think that's why Charlottesville is such a great food town, because there's so many passionate people in all realms. So
yeah. Wow, I never thought of it like that. Well, like, I always feel a little bit on the outside of the restaurant scene, because I'm the one coming in and eating, and, you know, if I am recognized, they're like, oh, crap, you know, or great, oh, she's been in here
you
before.
You don't like them having maybe a little bit of fear when you walk
no,
in?
No.
You cut your eye at them. Like,
no,
you know,
no.
I'm just kidding. Do you know who I am?
Right. I've seen, well, have you ever seen the movie Dinner Rush?
I haven't seen
Fantastic.
It.
Danny Aiello runs an Italian restaurant, mm-hmm. and Sandra Bernhardt is the New York Times restaurant reviewer, and she totally plays the part. It is hysterical. It's, you know, she's wants a certain table and a certain, he's, that dish isn't on the menu tonight. We'll put it on the menu. You know, I'm here, and she's wearing a wig, but obviously everybody knows who she is, and it's a great movie. Really good movie.
Dinner Rush. That's Dinner Rush. Rent it on Netflix. That's a sweet plug. Well, getting back to what you're doing now, you said that you have a kind of a rebranding happening. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, when I started Edible Seaville, I was so proud of myself because I thought it was a terrific name, you know, kind of catchy, kind of clever.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize there's also several hundred magazines with the title Edible and a place name after them, like all over the country.
Sure.
And they're owned by the same company. And not to go too far into it, I had a little bit of trouble with it at the beginning, but I think I'm such small potatoes, they don't really care.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a lot of disclaimers all over my site, if you look, that, you know, I have no part of this company and I'm not, you know, I'm a separate entity, blah, blah, blah. But it took me a while to think of a better name that would kind of encapsulate what I'm about and what I'm passionate about. And I am looking to rebrand and grow the site so it's easier to navigate, because I think right now it's hard to navigate all the different interests that I have in food. If you want to look at a restaurant, or if you want to read real food writing, or if you want to find a recipe, because I also cook and do recipes and bake.
Mm-hmm.
So the new website launching November 28th.
Wow.
Monday after Thanksgiving, when everybody's online.
That's true.
marketing. It's going to be called thedinerofseville.com.
Nice.
I actually had a contest and I said, guys, help me pick a name.
The Diner of Seville.
The Diner of Seville.
Yeah, that reminds me, at the barbecue exchange, we once had a pigism. Pigaro.
Well, I say my tagline, it's a veritable opera of food writing, you know, with lots of sass and gravy.
The Diner of Seville. I like that.
Yeah, I got the diner. And I also have I'm very passionate about photography, and I really like old neon signage.
Mm-hmm.
And old decrepit buildings. And I travel around in my car, and if I see like a rundown building, I'll pull over and take a picture. So I'm going to have a section with just diner signs. And I love vintage cookbooks.
You sound like my mom. She made us pull over and take a picture of a broken down building because the window looked so beautiful with the
paint. Yeah.
And she's going to paint it. So,
It's a kind of art, like the way, and there's so many of them around here. Like, just traveling down 29, like to Lynchburg, you pass like all kinds of old houses and
Well, if you run past any place that has an old neon sign that wants to get rid of it, because we'd love to have one at the barbecue exchange. We're thinking about having a guy chasing a pig with a cleaver or something.
I'll keep an eye out. You know, there's one, God, there used to be a great one in Front Royal, and it was called Mighty Fine Seafood.
Uh-huh.
And it was a neon of a dancing lobster and pig. It was awesome. Awesome. I have a vintage like polo with the logo on it that I have hanging in the closet because I don't want to mess it up.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it was fantastic. Great neon.
If you ever go to Colorado Springs in Manitou, where Donna and I had a hotel called the Cliff House, it's the land of the motel. Remember they called motor hotels?
Yeah.
and they all still have their vintage neon signs.
Oh, and
you know, you just drive down, you see these old neon signs, and yeah, it's what makes that place special now, because all those motor hotels have gone away to the Comfort Inns and
yeah.
the Holiday Inn Selects and everything.
Yeah, they've knocked them down. There's there's a few on 460. Like, we'll take 460 down to the Outer Banks, and there's a couple.
Yeah.
I've had the hubby pull the car over.
Now we're on to vintage
I know.
Neon signs.
I'm telling you.
But
like,
I really like them, too. So, I'm always trying to find them. I haven't found the right one yet, but one day we'll have a cool neon sign
right.
at the barbecue exchange, because it fits. You got to have it at a barbecue place.
There's of course.
Also great.
Something about pigs selling barbecue.
Yeah. Like. I wish I would have invented the Piggly Wiggly pig, actually, but I didn't. So what? Maybe one of these days. Getting back to your rebranding. So how do you break your blog down in sections?
Right. For the new blog, I'm still going to have, a lot of different types of readers. I'm going to have a section called Musings, mm-hmm. which is just straight food writing, you know,
right.
whether it's my thoughts on the recent Bourdain repair visit, or
sure.
maybe it's a culinary memory about Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
I've got another section of just recipes.
Right.
I have a huge collection of vintage cookbooks that are really odd. Just very strange Technicolor type
sure.
50s food. And I think it would be fun to highlight one of those recipes and maybe make it.
Right.
And see if it comes out the same. And so I'm going to have a vintage cookbook section too. And then I'm also really a really bad food photographer, so I'm trying to learn that.
Yeah.
So I'm going to have a section for my, maybe ask readers for hints or something.
There you go.
Boy, yeah, I mean, there's so many good food photographers in town. I'm just so jealous of Andrea Hubble and what she's doing at Bella Eats. Like, her mm-hmm. her work is so beautiful. So she's kind of my benchmark right now. I want my food photography to look like hers.
You know, I have to say, I haven't seen her site yet, Bella Eats.
Yeah,
so
Bella Eats.
Check it out.
She's done some great shots for Zinc Bistro uh-huh. on their
I've seen
website.
I've seen their pictures. And they're very nice.
Very, just gorgeous.
Yeah.
And yeah, and her site is beautiful, and she's got
Bella
a lot of
Eats, everybody.
BellaEats.com. Yeah.
We're going to have to check that out. So
yeah.
Back to your writing, and real quick, you went to see Anthony Bourdain
yes.
and Eric Repair. Our fella who we interviewed for last Sunday worked for Eric Repair
as
a chef de partie. And so his interview came out the same time that Eric Repair was talking at the Paramount. And he says that was the finest kitchen he's ever stepped foot in. He's worked in a couple 3-star Michelins in France. So
I've no doubt.
He said that Bernardin was clean.
Yep.
Organized, an exciting place to work. So,
yeah,
how was that interview?
It was great. I mean, you can really tell they're really good friends. They've been friends for a long time, and I just learned that friendship came about because of what Tony Bourdain wrote about fish. Don't eat fish on Monday in Kitchen uh-huh. Confidential, and Eric called him up and said, "Come to my restaurant. I want you to dine here," and they became friends from that. And it was like Rowan and Martin. I mean, from Laugh-In. I mean, they were just back and forth all night, like da 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 and da 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 da, and it was like jab jab and jab jab. Like it was hysterical. I was in stitches the whole time. When and in awe too, because I mean, I never even knew about food writing before Tony's book.
Well, and it was sold out, wasn't it?
Yeah,
a sold out affair with two chefs talking to each other.
Just
chewing the fat.
Just chewing the fat. That's all they were doing. They took they had each other on the hot seat for the first half, and they were, you know, answering accusations of, you know, certain types of accusations that had been made. And then for the second half, they took audience questions, and I got to crow a little bit here. They answered 5 of my questions.
Wow.
Yes, I had emailed them, and my husband was like, "Was that one of yours?" And I'm like, "Yes, yes." I was so excited. It was really cool.
Did you like their answers?
Yeah.
To your question.
Well, I asked the
Or
the
did they
junk-
say something like this? "We don't know who would ever ask this kind of question."
Exactly. No, it wasn't like that. But one of the questions, because I was dying to know, what is their secret junk food obsession that maybe they would be embarrassed to be caught eating?
Yeah.
And Eric Rapera said, "Oh, chorizo." And Anthony looked at him like, "Yeah, come on, buddy." Like, rolled his eyes, like, total, like, "Yeah, that's a bunch of BS. I'm not totally not buying that." And Tony's was the mac and cheese from either KFC or Popeyes.
Yeah.
And he talked about how he had snuck out of the house with a hoodie on, with the hood over his head. And,
yeah.
And then somebody recognizes him, and he's like, "Oh, crap." You know, caught.
I wonder if Eric Rapera actually eats Pop-Tarts or something like
that.
Well,
except that's what I was trying to find out. You know, he's...
"I like the Pop-Tart. It's very good. It has a good flavor, and it's crispy."
He's such a debonair, suave, tall drink of water. I mean, the women were swooned. I was surprised somebody didn't
that's
throw their underpants on the
like
stage.
Him.
I mean, he's gorgeous. Well, they're both... I think they're both gorgeous, but... the way he talks, and, "Oh, no, I sometimes sneak to the fridge at 2 a.m. for chorizo."
That's awesome.
Come on.
That's awesome. That's not junk food.
He never broke character. Right.
A beautifully made sausage. Come on, man.
Exactly.
Oh, wow.
It was a great night, and I got to go to the VIP party afterwards, and everybody wanted me to, they did a book signing.
Sure.
And everybody wanted me to stand in line, and there was no way. I would have gotten up there and fumfered and stuttered and just been stupid. So I just kind of admired from afar.
Oh, you didn't get up there and get a picture, and, you know.
No.
Because, you know, our friend Melissa, Melissa Hart Close, chef of Palladio, she has her picture with.
I saw.
So, and you know, Anthony Bourdain, when I first read his book, I thought it was great, but, you know, he picked like really bad restaurant that have happened in Kitchen Confidential. And so, you know, I kind of felt bad at first because that's not how my kitchen runs. So, but people would look at me and then say, "Oh, you're one of those guys that does that." And so that was a little upsetting. But, you know what? After a while, he's gained my respect with his television show and other things he does. But
yeah,
that book, that kind of set me back just a little.
Well, and that book, too, is not his best. Mm-hmm. It's the one he actually wrote fiction. He wrote three fiction novels. They're kind of mafia gangster-based novels.
They would be.
And they're good beach reads. Bone in the Throat, it's a great book. I was going to take that to sign. I said, if I get anything to sign, I'll have him sign that one. But... And I liked Kitchen just because I had never seen that world. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd worked in it, but I hadn't seen that part of it. Mm-hmm. I think he's gotten better as a food writer since then, like with his articles and magazines. Cook's Tour was a really good book. His piece on Cambodia was amazing. And Medium Raw, Nasty Bits was okay.
Yeah.
Medium Raw, to me, is his best work. I think it's the best food writing he's done. It's really... And a lot of that night, he used material from that book. A lot of the topics were about that.
Yeah. I once banned him from the Cornell Hotel School guest chefs thing because the students really wanted him. I'm like, "No, I'm not having that guy here." And
he's trouble.
But you know what's funny? I finally got into the book, and he wrote about his time at CIA with Chef Bernard. And this was a story I had told my children about Chef Bernard, and they never really believed me. So he actually, you know, a lot of my stories, I was talking to my family about this tonight, may seem kind of like lies. So this is the one time that I have somebody who has definitely backed me up. And so I'm thankful to Anthony Bourdain for putting down on paper the story of Chef Bernard at the Culinary Institute, who's one of the true characters and maybe one of the best people I've ever had the chance to work with in my life. So,
which is pretty cool.
Getting back, yes, I'm thankful to Anthony Bourdain for putting Chef Bernard down on paper. And actually, after I really delved into the book, I started to feel better about him. So, you know, my first thoughts about him were wrong. I think he's one of the true.
Well, you're not alone. A lot of chefs had the same reaction. Yeah. They're like, "That's not my kitchen." And
I know. Well, you know, we're
what the heck?
You know, if you're professional, and you run a good kitchen, you don't want people to think that every kitchen is a bunch of crazy people. You want them to realize that these are, you know, the really good kitchens, like the one Eric Rapera runs at La Bernardin, are methodical and they're passionate, and they have a lot of work to put out, because you know cooking and a restaurant's all about timing, and it's all about excitement. And I thought that about him, but afterwards, and now knowing all of these different TV chefs that are out there, he's one that's kind of stayed true to himself. And I think it's pretty cool. So
yeah, definitely. Well, and you know, like I've eaten, my husband and I have eaten at a lot of really high end, you know, 2 and 3 Michelin star places.
Sure.
But it's not my favorite way to eat. Like it's and you see the work. Mm-hmm. I mean, you definitely see the work that goes into. We had a Joel Robichon in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Holy cow!
One of the greatest chefs ever on the face of the earth.
And who? Eric Repair said was one of his mentors, mm-hmm. and I didn't know that, and so that was really interesting to learn. And having eaten at his restaurant, and I was, a lot of it's the choreography of the service, mm-hmm. as well as the dishes, and also the ambience. But you really do feel like you're in church, and you need to sit up straight, and you know, hands enough. In your lap, and I'd much rather go eat barbecue.
Yeah, I thank you.
Pick
very
crabs.
Much for that. Well, let's ask then, top 2 or 3 meals you've ever had in your life?
In my life?
Yeah, in your life.
Oh, my God. You know what? The best meal I ever had in my life was still in Florence, Italy, at the White Boar.
At the White Boar.
The White Boar. It little trattoria on the south side of the river there,
right.
In Florence, down some steps. It was the bistecca, the Florentine beefsteak.
Sure.
And it was topped with basil and the new olive oil because it was November.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And then pappardelle with boar, like a boar ragu.
Wow.
House-made limoncello. It was effing amazing. I still dream about that meal.
Yeah, yeah.
It was such a small place and so homey and simple, and the flavors were so clear and nothing was convoluted, you know, not a bunch of sauce and stuff. I mean, it was just the ingredients really like sang through, and it was still the number one,
Now, Charlottesville regional area, any favorite new places you found or something that just recently kind of jumped out at you to, was pretty exciting and made you happy?
You know, I can't talk about Zenadoa enough. I really like what they're doing there. I really do. And the only way I can put it, it is upscale, but it doesn't feel upscale. It feels very homespun.
And is that in Stanton?
In Stanton.
Right.
And the pork and bean dish that I had there last winter was one of the best things I've eaten since I've moved to Charlottesville.
That's nice. It's nice to hear you say that pork and beans could be.
I'm telling you. Oh, my God. And there was so much there I took it home in a doggy bag, and it was even better the next day.
Yeah.
And I got to sing out the Korea House over here on Carlton. We just went there for the first time, and I had bibimbap, which is it's a dish of vegetables and rice. And they put a fried egg on top, and there's a little bit of meat in it,
mm-hmm.
a little bit of sauce, and they bring it in this sizzling clay pot, and the rice gets all crunchy on the bottom, and you mix it up with the chopsticks. Oh, my God. It's my new favorite comfort food.
Say the name of that dish again.
The Korea House, and it's called bibimbap. Get the bibimbap.
The bibimbap. sounds like a song.
Yeah, the bibimbap.
Yeah, it sounds like a song. Hey, we could do that at the barbecue exchange.
Yeah, you could. It's just like
the Korea house.
You totally could, because it's just cabbage and rice, and then stick a little barbecue
on top.
Do they
make kimchi over there? Do they have kimchi?
Heck yeah, homemade.
All right.
It's good.
Yeah, we'll be headed to the Korea house on Carlton. That's not that very far from the studios, the beautiful studios of Chew the Fat.
Exactly.
Right, Mike? Have you been to the Korea house?
No, I have not, but I've always thought about it driving by.
Well, now you're going to go,
it's
right?
Good.
And motivation.
We'll go together.
You got it. I'm in.
Well, cool. Well, Janae, it's been really nice having you here.
Thank you so much.
And I can't wait to see your new blog.
Yes,
guys. Diner of Seville.
TheDinerOfSeville.com. It's up now, so if you want to go check it out early, you can, but... formal announcement, formal launch will be on the 28th. I'm still working out a few kinks with the navigation. Sure. But feel free, offer suggestions.
Anything else you'd want to tell listeners about yourself, your blog, anything that you want them to know that we haven't talked about?
Yeah. Eat Charlottesville food. You know, we've got a lot of good restaurants here and a lot of hardworking people. And, you know, go to the farms, buy local. It's all here. You don't have to go anywhere else. It's all here. And eat seasonally, too, because it's only good in season. Peaches are not good in November. Eat them in July.
True enough. Well, listen, thank you very much. It's been great having you here tonight.
Great. Thank you so much.
Folks, you've been listening to Chew the Fat with Chef Craig Hartman, tonight with Janae Libby from Edible Seaville, soon to be called the Diner of Seaville. And we will be singing the Barbecue Exchange song there, Pigaro, Pigaro, Pigaro. So anyway, thanks again, and write us some comments. Tell us what you think. If you have anybody in particular you'd like me to interview, please let me know. I appreciate all your comments. Even the ones about Levi Messick the other day. So thank you, folks, and out.
I wasn't gonna sing the song tonight or this decade, but I realized sometime earlier this year that it had been 26 years since this come out as a movie, and it was 2 years before that that it came out as a record, and it was 2 years ago on the record, which means it was like 30 Thanksgivings ago, 30 years ago on Thanksgiving, when my friend and I decided to go up and visit Alice at the restaurant. But Alice didn't used to live in a restaurant. She used to live in the church nearby the restaurant, in the bell tower, with her husband Ray and Facha the dog. And living in the bell tower like that, they used to have a lot of room downstairs where the pews used to be. Seeing as how they took out all of the pews and having all that room, they decided that they didn't have to take out their garbage for a long time. We got up there, found the place was filled with garbage, and we decided it'd be a friendly gesture for us to take the garbage down to the town dump. So we took the half a ton of garbage, put it in the back of a red VW microbus, took shovels and rakes and implements of destruction and headed on toward the town dump. We got there, and there was a sign, a chain across the road, and the sign said, closed on Thanksgiving. We had never heard of a dump closed on Thanksgiving before. And so with tears in our eyes, we drove off into the sunset, looking for another place to put the garbage. We didn't find one, till we come to a side road. And off of the side of the side road, there was a 15-foot cliff. And at the bottom of the cliff, there was another pile of garbage. We decided that one big pile would be better than two little ones. And rather than bring that one up, we decided to throw ours down. That's what we did. Drove back to the church, had a Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat. Went to sleep and didn't get up until the next morning, when we got a phone call from Officer Obie. He said, kid, we found your name on an envelope at the bottom of a half a ton of garbage. Just wanted to know if you had any information about it. And I said, yes, sir, Officer Obie. I cannot tell a lie. I put it.